murmurs, then collects himself and continues.
Would a young lady of your station really court a man of mine?
If she cared for him, of course, I answer. And anyway, you come from a perfectly respectable station. Your family owns extensive lands in Long Island, and you run your own successful business.
So, is that why you come to my shop, Elizabeth?
I force myself to hold his gaze, to show him that I am unafraid to embrace this connection. In part, I watch as his fingers move across the polished wood of the counter toward mine. For a brief moment, our fingertips touch, and our eyes meet. But then the intensity of his gaze overwhelms me, and I blurt out, "But there is another reason I came today." Disappointment registers on his face, and he withdraws his hand.
"There is.
Major Andre and his men will arrive back in New York tomorrow. My parents received word from one of the few officers that remain in the city. The British want us to prepare our homes for hosting again." Robert is quiet. When he doesn't speak for a long moment, I say, "I thought you'd be pleased that my source of information has returned. You've mentioned that General Washington has been grumbling about the lack of intelligence coming from the Culper Ring since Andre left for Charleston. He might even disband it."
"Of course. But with the return of Andre comes the return of your involvement with them. I loathe the thought of you consorting with the British, dancing with them, dining with them, even talking with them. I cannot stop thinking about the night we first met, when that awful colonel was attempting to interfere with you."
He takes a deep breath.
"I don't want you to compromise yourself to obtain information."
"You needn't worry, Robert. Even as a woman, I'm capable of protecting myself against British advances while obtaining information, and not compromising myself while doing so. There have been no more instances of the sort you witnessed the night we first met, and there never will be again. I won't be so foolhardy."
"I know you're capable, Elizabeth, and you're the antithesis of foolish. It's just that...
He pauses.
"I care about you too much to risk you."
Chapter 8. July 20th, 1780. New York, New York. The largest of the summer balls unfolds before me. This particular one hosted by several families at the Assembly Hall, because no one home can accommodate this large affair. But my mind is not on the festooned revelers who swirl past me. Instead, I'm thinking about the success of the past few weeks, and a special evening Robert and I shared in its wake. And I'm smiling to myself. Immediately upon the British soldiers' return to New York, riding high on their capture of Charleston, rumors began to surface about a French fleet sailing to our shores to aid the Continental Army. But no one knew where these ships would land, not even General Washington. I listened to many conversations in which British officers speculated about the location, and I learned that General Clinton planned to send troops and ships to attack the French on the Rhode Island coast, where he believed they would make shore. The moment I heard this, I raced to tell Robert. My intelligence led to an intricate plot in which Washington leaked false information to the British, indicating that he planned to take back New York while Clinton's troops were in Rhode Island, and thereby prompting Clinton to turn back from Rhode Island and giving the French unimpeded access to our shore. This victory was one that Robert and I celebrated in the privacy of his shop after closing time, with a toast and our first real kiss. I return to the present moment, wondering whether another opportunity for espionage will present itself this evening. At several recent gatherings and dinners, I've noticed a certain smugness adopted by the British officers, even beyond the swagger with which they returned from Charleston, a swagger that was not diminished by their failure to intercept the French in Rhode Island. What is happening, I wonder, to justify this new confidence? Will I learn its source tonight? I find the men to be strangely silent once I'm in their presence. Several seemingly innocent queries placed with the usual cadre of officers yield nothing, and I begin to despair of learning some tightly held secret. Frustrated at the British recalcitrance, I stand near the ballroom door with a group of young women I've known my whole life, talking, as usual, about nothing. It is then that Major André himself sidles up to me and asks for a dance. The other women raise eyebrows and whisper among themselves as the musicians strike the first few chords of a minuet. Although the polished, attractive Major André is notoriously flirtatious with most of the young ladies, he only dances with a select few. He rests one hand on my waist and another on my shoulder, and I find myself nervous in the presence of the central British intelligence officer. The man with spies and schemes abounding, the man upon whom I have been spying. Will he sniff out an intruder in his midst?
How is it that we've been in each other's company often over these past months, and yet we've never danced?
He poses a question that I'm sure he's asked countless times to countless women. I think it must be because you've never asked, sir. He guffaws, a rather jolting sound coming from his compact mouth.
Nicely said, Miss... Apologies for not knowing your name.
Miss Morris, sir, and please don't apologize. I have the advantage in that, while there are many young loyalist women in this town, there is only one you. He laughs again, drawing the attention of the ever-present audience on the periphery of the dance floor.
I'm glad to learn that we have such witty loyalist women in our midst.
Loyalist women who are excited to have you back. We welcomed the news from Charleston, but we're so pleased that you have all returned to New York and that you're winning this fight.
I appreciate your support, Miss Morris. Our victories in New York and Charleston are only the beginning. We will soon have the entire coast at our disposal.
Here it is, I think. This innuendo must be the source of the heightened British confidence I've observed. But what exactly is going to yield the coast to the British? I'm so close to the secreted truth, and I cannot allow the opportunity to pass, even though it's risky to pursue the information I seek. While I muse on the best course, I respond with the flattery he expects. I have no doubt of it, Major André. Do I dare ask him the leading sort of questions I've posed to the others? Will he suspect me? Maybe he asked me to dance because he suspects me already. The Major continues,
Don't think that will be easy, Miss Morris. Although the Continental Army is a gaggle of ragtag upstarts in comparison to our well-trained troops, they have the fury of the indignant, unwarranted though that may be. Still, I have no doubt that we will prevail.
Putting aside Robert's ongoing concerns about my safety, I decide to take the risk. It may be my only chance. It sounds as though securing the coast. I think that's what you said, I add with false uncertainty. Will be instrumental in the British success, yes?
Ah, you've been listening, he teases. Yes, we have plans in motion that will deliver the seaboard to us. Now I cannot tell you more, even though you are a dutiful citizen of the Crown. I can, however, assure you that you have no reason to worry.
I'd never worry with you in charge, Major André. You will surely ensure that our land is fully restored to British rule soon. And I wouldn't understand the details of your plans anyway.
I don't doubt that, dear girl, and I wouldn't tax you so. But be assured in that we have a leader of the Continental Army in alignment with our views. And that will help our cause immeasurably.
I nod blankly and turn the conversation to the sorts of entertainment he enjoys in England. We thus converse on an utterly inane topic as I turn the information he shared round and round in my mind.
Those were his precise words?
Robert asks the next afternoon, his voice raised excitedly. I repeat them. Yes, André said, we have a leader of the Continental Army in alignment with our views, and that will help our cause immeasurably. This person must be in one of the commanding roles somewhere along the coast, given the context. Robert shakes his head in disbelief.
Washington has a traitor in his midst, and a senior officer at that.
So it would seem.
But who?
I've been thinking through every possibility, and I would venture to guess that leader is tied to one of the waterfront forts. Perhaps West Point? I understand that its location, on a sharp bend in the Hudson River, would allow it to dictate ships' access to the river, and thus the state. And we know how important New York is to the success of either side.
Yes, it's very strategic. Although I don't think the fort currently has a commander.
Maybe the leader that Andre mentioned is attempting to secure the command. Robert nods and reaches for my hand.
You've outdone yourself, Elizabeth.
I feel my cheeks flush with his compliment as I hold his hand in mine. Thank you, Robert. Despite his praise, his expression is somber, and he says,
But I worry about the position in which you might have had to place yourself to acquire this information.
What do you mean?
Andre has a reputation.
He did not dishonor me, Robert. I squeeze his hand. I know it may be inconceivable to you, you who don't think less of women's intellect. But almost every other man believes he can tell anything to a woman without repercussions because of our inherent inability to understand. And such men don't need special encouragement to reveal their secrets. Even a spy master. Chapter 9. September 18th, 1780. New York, New York. My heart races as I pad down the stairs. I carry my shoes and am careful to avoid the step with the notorious creak, and yet the wooden stairs screech as I descend. I pause, wanting to ensure I haven't roused Officer Randolph, who has commandeered my father's study on the first floor as his bedchamber ever since he returned from Charleston. Hearing nothing other than my father's light snore, I continue downstairs. I know I should wait a full minute before crossing the entryway to the kitchen, but I am eager. This new information cannot wait until market day. If I can make it to the back hallway without detection, then I should be clear to exit out the servants' door, I think. Placing one foot in front of the other with care, I creep across the foyer, past the dining room and toward the kitchen, still hot from the summer warmth and the dying embers from the ovens. Once inside the kitchen, I reach for the small parcel I've hidden in a cupboard and walk toward the door. It is then that I hear a noise. I spin around, only to find Colonel Randolph standing in the doorway to the kitchen. My heart beats wildly as I realize I've been caught.
What are you doing?
He asks, rubbing his bleary eyes. Hoping that my voice sounds light, I offer my prepared response as I pull my robe tighter around me to ensure my sheer white nightgown is fully covered. Just looking for a late-night bite to eat from the larder. Would you like something as well? The slight, exacting soldier stares at me, and I'm not certain whether he doubts me or is simply tired and confused.
It's more dawn than midnight, he says.
Smoothing his unruly curls, he cranes his neck to look at the tall case clock in the foyer.
It's nearly 3 o'clock in the morning. Plenty strange for you to wander downstairs at this hour, Miss Morris.
I suppose I didn't eat enough for dinner. I stroll to the larder and pull out a hunk of cheese and the remains of the day's bread. Can I offer you some? Shaking his head, he stares at me quizzically, finally saying,
No, thank you. We have an early morning, and I'm not well pleased to have been awoken. We are trained to be on high alert for the rebels, you know.
I freeze. Did the colonel say the word rebels? I force myself to react calmly, even lightheartedly, as if he could not possibly affix that label to me. But now I wonder if he harbors suspicions about me. My apologies, Colonel, I say, then glance around the room. There are no rebels here, as you can see, only me. And I did endeavor to be quiet, but I'm sorry that I woke you. With a final glance, he takes his leave, and I am forced to go through the charade of eating until I estimate that he's had enough time to fall back asleep. Parcel in hand, I open the back door as slowly and silently as possible and creep outside. Standing against the wall of the house, behind a shed used for tools, I put my father's pants and shirt over my nightdress, slide on a pair of boots, and tuck my hair in a hat, hoping I'll be mistaken for an errand boy working for an early morning business. And then I run.
"What in the name of God are you doing here at this hour, Elizabeth? You know it's not safe,"
he whispers as he guides me into his shop. I start to talk, but he places a finger over my lips.
"We shouldn't be seen in here, and the light gives us away. It's too suspicious. Let's head upstairs to my rooms."
For all the time that Robert and I have spent together, for all the secrets we have shared and feelings we have confessed, he has never invited me into his rooms over the shop. An unmarried man and woman alone together, particularly in the dead of night, breaches every boundary of propriety. I am still breathless from my dash down the pitch-dark streets, so I take a moment to sit in the chair he offers me in his dining area. As he lights a few lamps around the room, I see that his kitchen, dining room, and parlor are essentially one large chamber, tidy and clean, but very plain. No Chippendale furniture or John Singleton Copley portraits here. The sole hint of any sort of decoration or indulgence is the stacks of books on the table and near the cushioned chair drawn close to the fireplace. I glimpse a few of the titles, some of which are familiar. William Camden's Britannia, a historical account of early England. Henry Holmes' Principles of Equity, a study of various legal systems. And a particular favorite of mine, John Locke's Two Treatises of Government. He finally settles into the carved wooden chair next to me, takes my hand in his, and asks, "What's happened?" "I believe Major Andre has left New York this very evening to meet his turncoat general," I say. "I overheard the critical facts from Andre himself at a church luncheon this afternoon, which was attended by soldiers and citizens alike." As the luncheon progressed, I noticed an increase in pointed glances, congratulatory backslaps, and surreptitious toasts among the officers, which heightened my suspicions that the plan to which Andre first alluded nearly 2 months ago was currently in motion.
"Did you hear anyone reference the name of the leader? A particular general, perhaps?" he asks.
While he'd gotten word to Washington about the notion of this traitorous leader, no evidence had yet emerged about his exact identity, only guesses. Robert and I have a suspicion as to who this man may be, but haven't managed to find proof to implicate him. We know that identifying the traitor is of the utmost importance. If the British could capture the strategic fort of West Point through the treachery of one of Washington's key men, it would be an unimaginable coup. General Washington might never recover. No, there was no confirmation of a name. But I did overhear Andre say that he was heading north for a few days, that he was leaving tonight after his send-off dinner, as he described it. And West Point is, of course, north. Robert finishes the sentence for me. Yes. Then, not 5 minutes later, I swear I heard one of his men mention White Plains, which would be on the way to West Point. I am guessing that Andre has a rendezvous with this traitor, and that they are finalizing the details of the handover of West Point to the British.
Which would give the British an enormous advantage over the Continental Army in New York, and beyond.
Exactly. Now do you understand why I had to come? We need to get this information to Washington now, so we can stop the meeting from ever happening and arrest this general as a traitor.
You're right to come, Elizabeth, although I hate the dangers to which you must subject yourself. I hope you didn't have to suffer through another dance with Andre to procure this information.
No. Thankfully, he hasn't asked me again. Robert appears visibly relieved, but then his brow furrows.
My contact isn't due here for 2 days, so I'll have to take the message myself to his conduit to Washington.
No, Robert. That's too big a risk.
Not if it appears as though I'm simply visiting my family in Long Island.
Can you safely relay the information to Washington from there?
I'll have to hand it over directly to the conduit at his business in Long Island, which will be a bit tricky, but I believe we can manage it. From there, the conduit should be able to get it to Washington at his headquarters in New Jersey through his normal channels.
He squeezes my hand and leans in to gently kiss me. I cannot allow you to be the only member of the Culper Ring to take these enormous risks.
He pauses for a moment and adds,
Do you still believe that we've identified the right man?
Yes. With his recent appointment at West Point and his wife's family ties to the Loyalists, Major Andre in particular, it just can't be a coincidence.
And so we found our traitor, or at least we believed we had.
General Benedict Arnold. Chapter 10.
Damn shame.
My father slaps the newspaper down on the dining room table, causing the Wedgwood china to vibrate. I've just entered the room for breakfast, and I cannot imagine what would prompt him to swear, an unprecedented act in my experience.
This will be horrific for business.
Language, Richard, my mother scolds, but she doesn't comment on the source of his outrage. She continues stirring her tea. What's happened? I ask.
Remember that Major Andre, dear? Very nice fellow, she says.
Yes, I venture warily.
Well, it seems that his primary job wasn't aiding General Clinton after all, as he led us to believe. He was serving as an intelligence officer, gathering up rebel secrets and the like, if you can imagine it. Apparently, he'd struck some sort of deal for a continental general to switch sides to the British, and he was found behind enemy lines after a meeting with this general.
Really? How on earth did he get caught? I ask.
It seems he stumbled into a roadblock when he was leaving his meeting in the countryside, she answers,
and I realize that the roadblock had been erected based on my report about Andre's meeting and whereabouts.
When he was arrested, Major Andre had very damaging papers on his person. A map of West Point and a document signed by the general who ran the fort.
She turns to my father.
What was his name, Richard?
Arnold. General Benedict Arnold.
Yes, that's it.
My heart pounds in my chest, and the room begins to sway. All my suspicions have proven accurate, and I know, without a shred of doubt, that it was my information delivered to Robert just days ago that upended this plot.
What is it, dear?
My mother asks, noticing a change in my expression.
A lot of the girls fancied Major Andre. Perhaps our Elizabeth is no exception,
my father comments, almost humorously. I compose myself and answer as if I am still the old Elizabeth, the innocent girl who could exchange quips with her father and resist her mother's attempts to make her more marriageable, the young woman who preferred staying home in the evening with a book by the fire to attending a bustling party. I barely remember her anymore. Now I'm a new Elizabeth, a spy for the Continental Army who deceives her family and friends in order to pry information from the British.
Don't be silly, Father. He was too much of a fop for my taste.
Oh, Elizabeth, we will never find you a suitable husband with that attitude.
And I thought you'd really begun to change,
my mother says. I sit down in my usual chair across from them at the table, reach for a piece of bread as if it is a normal morning, and only then pick up the newspaper as casually as I can.
So what happened to Major Andre and this Arnold fellow? Are they both under arrest?
Ah, there is a bit of good news there,
my father says.
It seems that Major Andre was arrested before the rebels fully understood that this Arnold fellow was about to betray them. And so one of their colonels notified Arnold that they had a British officer in custody with papers bearing his name. Arnold, of course, understood that it was only a matter of time before the rebels comprehended that he was in league with this Major Andre, and came to arrest him as well.
What did Arnold do? I ask, holding my breath, praying that they got Arnold despite his foreknowledge.
Well, this gaffe on the part of the Continental Colonel gave Arnold time to escape before the rebels realized that he was part of the scheme. Arnold reached the British, and now they have him to use as an asset, even though they lost the chance to take West Point.
He chuckles.
Imagine Washington's face when he arrived at the fort expecting to see General Arnold, only to discover that he'd fled in the nick of time.
But poor Major Andre, he's still imprisoned. My mother sighs.
And he was such a nice gentleman.
Yes, he was, I answer without thinking. My mind is focused elsewhere, churning with questions that would shock and dismay my parents if they knew. What does it mean that Major Andre was caught, but General Arnold escaped? Will Arnold realize that Andre stepped into our trap? If so, how long will it be before the British begin to hunt down the spies who gathered that information? I am haunted by the thought that Arnold knows about the Culper Ring. I am riddled with fear, but cannot show it. I must proceed apace with normal life, as normal a life as can be led in wartime, continuing with the daily cycle of a lady's activities and attending the required social gatherings. Otherwise, I risk drawing attention to myself, and scrutiny is something I can ill afford. For weeks, the lavish parties continue despite the mourning over the hanging of Major Andre on General Washington's orders. I attend, but do not make any inquiries or listen where I am not wanted. Instead, I dance when asked. I drink when libations are proffered. I engage in ladylike conversations about the weather, people's health, and the evening's festivities. And I wish to be forgotten. I make no contact with Robert. If his family's former allegiances attract scrutiny of him and his shop, as he has intimated, I must stay away. British eyes will undoubtedly be everywhere. Although I yearn for him, his voice, his dark eyes, the brilliance of his rare, unexpected smiles, his loyalty, his watchfulness and care, and the touch of his hands. I must wait alone. That does not mean I can entirely close my ears, of course. I hear Officer Randolph talk in my parents' home about the desire for revenge over the spoiled plot and the death of Major Andre. I attend to the murmurings on High Street, in the church and the park, and over afternoon tea, all whispering about Arnold's hunt for the spies who exposed the plan that he and Andre concocted. I feel British eyes on me everywhere, even when I am in the privacy of my bedchamber. And I begin to wonder if the threat is real or imagined. I sit up with a jolt. Did I hear the sound of something falling or breaking? I gaze around my bedroom, seeing only the outline of my bureau against the background of the moon and nothing out of the ordinary. I decide I'd been dreaming and try to return to sleep. A few minutes later, I hear the noise again, realizing that it's the hard strike of a rock on the window. I bolt awake and rise from my bed. Wrapping my robe around me, I walk to the window and peer down onto our side yard. I see a lanky figure near the hedge, and I recognize the silhouette immediately. Robert. Thank God. I light a candle and raise my hand to indicate that I've seen him. Motioning for him to join me in the backyard, I creep down the stairs, praying that I do not wake Colonel Randolph again. An excuse of a late-night repast will not be accepted a second time. I pass through the back door and into the garden behind the house unnoticed. This is the province of the servants, littered with clotheslines, washing bins, and carts. Their belongings will shield us from any wakeful inhabitants of the house, as will a small grove of trees. Robert, I say, racing to his side. He wraps his arms around me, and for the first time in weeks, I feel safe and known.
I'm so sorry I've left you out here on your own. I've wanted to knock on your parents' door so many times these past weeks, he says.
Hush. I place my finger on his lips, relishing the soft texture of his skin. That would have been foolish for us both. That's why I stayed away from your store. His face is shadowy in the dark, but in the low light of the moon, I can see his eyes looking into mine. His voice cracks with emotion as he says,
Your discovery allowed Washington to stop the British takeover of West Point and brought down their chief spy.
That's what I had hoped.
But at what cost?
What do you mean? I ask, fearing that I already know the answer.
You must know. As a Continental Army general,
Arnold has been informed about the existence of the Culper Ring, although he hadn't been told the names of its members. But he realizes that we're the ones to have uncovered his plot, and he is circling around us, drawing close. I'm terribly worried that he'll identify us soon and give the British our names.
I've been hearing whispers about Arnold and the British desperation to find the spies, but I didn't realize they were near to discovering us.
All the terror that had been wound tightly within me over the past week's releases, and I begin crying.
What are we going to do?
Robert wipes away the tears streaming down my cheeks, never loosening his hold on me.
I have a plan, but I don't want you to think me presumptuous.
I would never think that, Robert. I know you, and I know you have my well-being at heart, and I know how you feel about me.
He stares into my eyes, and with his finger, traces the path of my drying tears. I allow my cheek to rest in his palm, and for a long moment, I feel at peace. Then he says,
Elizabeth, will you marry me?
No matter my assurances about his plan, I am stunned. In my sphere, marriage is a decision that's made by a family, not an individual. But, I remind myself, I am operating far outside the normal sphere. And with sudden certainty, I know this is the right course. Life with this serious, moral man will never be the easy life of plenty my parents envision for me, but it will be the life of goodness and integrity and purpose for which I long. He fills my silence with words.
We could marry and then leave New York together as a couple, before they identify us. I've mapped out a way for us to make it safely to New Jersey or Connecticut, where General Washington could protect us. Of course, I know this isn't the normal manner of courting an engagement, as I haven't approached your parents. They would never approve anyway. You wouldn't have the formal wedding and party that you deserve, and would have to sneak away in the dead of night afterward, but...
Again, I place my finger on his lips.
Shh, my dearest Robert. I will marry you. The details of how we go about our union are unimportant to me. All that matters is that I will become your wife.
Chapter 11. October 25th, 1780. New York, New York. The tiny stone chapel of St. Paul's, tucked away in a field on Broadway, is beautiful in its spareness. Gleaming white walls glow in the golden late morning sun, and the burnished oak pews and altar only heighten the illumination. The church is empty, save for us three, and it seems fitting that the minister will marry us in this place which was claimed by the early supporters of the revolution. Robert and I stand before the altar, hand in hand, the folds of my simple lilac gown pooling at our feet. We face the minister he knows from childhood, a man secretly sympathetic to the cause of the revolution, even though he leads a loyalist congregation. Robert had once considered approaching him about undertaking intelligence work for the cause, but once he understood the breadth of the minister's pacifist leanings, he abandoned the notion. The minister has warned us that the ceremony will unite us before God, but not before the government, whichever one ends up winning this war. According to the law, my parents have the right to deny me permission to marry, and we had not the time nor consent to post the banns, our declaration of intent to marry, at any church, as is tradition and rule. It's only been 12 hours since Robert's proposal, after all. But we do not care. I glance at Robert, who stares at me with a wide grin of disbelief, as if I might disappear in an instant, like a specter. I smile back at him to assure him that I am indeed flesh and blood, and I am his. The minister begins.
We gather together here in the sight of God to join together this man and this woman in holy matrimony.
He continues with the familiar litany about the meaning of the sacrament, but I only half listen.
I'm too transfixed by the glorious smile on Robert's face and the happiness in his eyes. I can only imagine that I appear the same.
Elizabeth Morris, wilt thou have this man to be thy wedded husband, to live together after God's ordinance in the holy estate of matrimony? Wilt thou obey him, serve him, love, honor, and keep him in sickness and in health, and forsaking all others, keep thee only unto him, so long as ye both shall live?
I will.
Robert Townsend, wilt thou have this woman to thy wedded wife, to live together after God's ordinance, in the holy estate of matrimony? Wilt thou love, honor, and keep her in sickness and in health, and forsaking all others, keep thee only unto her, so long as ye both shall live?
I will.
He hands Robert a ring, a simple band of silver with a lovely flower design along its rim. As Robert slides it on my finger, he repeats after the minister,
"With this ring, I thee wed. With my body I thee worship, and with all my worldly goods I thee endow."
After the minister's final blessing, we exit by the side door of St. Paul's, daring to hold hands as we walk down the lanes to Townsend's dry goods shop. The store, which I have visited often in both daylight and moonlight, seems different now that I am Robert's wife. After he unlocks the door, he leads me upstairs to his rooms, which I have only ever visited at night. To my surprise, bouquets of blue asters, purple-spotted bee balm, and goldenrod festoon the room, and their fragrant perfume fills the air. As I turn toward Robert in delight, he says,
"I cannot offer you much right now, but I wanted our wedding day to be as celebratory as I could make it."
"What you have offered me is all that I have ever wanted." He pulls me close to him.
"What you have offered me is more than I ever knew existed."
Wrapping me in his arms, he engulfs me in a kiss, then leads me to his bedroom. The sun wanes by late afternoon when I am preparing to leave Robert's shop, but the day is no less beautiful and bright. In Robert's arms, I listen as he whispers,
"I don't want you to leave."
His voice is thick with desire and regret.
"Neither do I," I whisper into his chest.
Then, in an effort to sound more hopeful, I say, "But it will be only 8 short hours until we rendezvous, and then we will be together forever."
"Those hours will be endless," he groans.
"I know. But you have much to do by way of packing for us. I'll have to slip out with only a small bag to avoid detection, so you'll have to prepare for us both. Then I'll be yours for all time."
"For all time,"
he echoes, a note of wonder in his voice, and he engulfs me in a long farewell kiss. I walk the distance home in a euphoric daze. As I stroll, the remains of Trinity Church, which once boasted the tallest structure in the city in its steeple, capture my attention, and I wonder when it will be reconstructed after the fire that razed much of the city. I cannot help but think that, despite the unorthodox nature of our marriage, a benevolent God would look kindly upon our union today. As I approach my parents' home, I begin to worry. How will my parents react when they read my letter tomorrow morning and they learn about my marriage and departure? Will they discover the hand I had in Andre's arrest and the upending of Arnold's plot? And what will the British do to my parents if their investigation reveals my involvement? Regardless of my worries, I know I cannot alert my mother and father too soon, or I risk ruining our plan. So I slide my wedding ring off my finger and hide it deep within a pocket in the folds of my skirt. Pulling open the front door, I step inside to a scene I could have never imagined. My mother stands at the base of the entryway stairs, clutching the banister, her cheeks wet with tears. My father's usually perfectly styled hair is askew, and he is arguing with an unfamiliar British officer who is surrounded by at least six of his men. Colonel Randolph stands behind them, his arms crossed and a self-satisfied expression on his face. The commotion halts when they see me. My mother screams, "Run, Elizabeth, run!" As I pivot and attempt to leave, I meet my father's gaze and see within his deep blue eyes an excess of anguish and helplessness. I hesitate for a second, and in that momentary pause, one of the men grasps my hand just as I'm about to flee through the door. As he grips both my arms and yanks them behind my back, the senior officer marches to my side and announces,
"Elizabeth Morris, you are under arrest for treason."
Chapter 12. I am taken from my family home in shackles. The British march me down the high street, announcing to anyone who will listen that they have captured the spy responsible for the betrayal of Major André and, ultimately, his death. We pass neighbors and family friends of many years, and the astonishment on their expressions as they watch me in chains makes real the hellacious fate awaiting me. The HMS Jersey. Everyone in New York has heard stories about the notorious prison ship, where rebels are held and where the appalling conditions yield a life expectancy of only a few months. Consequently, as the British soldiers take me by carriage to the docks at Wallabout Bay, I think I know what terrors to expect once I'm on board. But I am wrong. No newspaper article or overheard conversation could prepare me for this reality. After I climb up the ladder to board, I am transferred into the hands of the notorious commissary Joshua Loring. Even in the society circles of New York, I'd heard talk of this reprehensible creature, who enjoys inflicting the harshest of conditions on his prisoners and hoards the meager food and drink allotted to them to trade on the black market for his own gain. Loring laughs when he learns he'll have a woman on board.
"A novelty for your fellow prisoners and a plaything for them as well,"
he comments, and passes me off to his second in command. It is this man who pushes me down the flight of nearly vertical stairs into the hull of the Jersey. If hell could take earthly form, it would resemble this ship. Half-dead bodies are strewn about the rough wooden floor in various states of undress, as there are neither beds nor hammocks, not even benches. Those prisoners still able to stand or sit upright against the inwardly curving wood slat walls are racked with cough and covered with scabs. They're dressed in what I could only describe as rags. There are so many men in the cramped, windowless space that those clinging to life overlap with cadavers on the floor, and the rodents scurry over them. But worse than the illness, worse than the crowding, worse than the degenerated state of the prisoners, worse than the constant moaning, is the smell, which contains elements of rotten food, decaying flesh, fetid water, men long unwashed, and some stench far worse than any single one of those. I cower in the corner closest to the stairs, thinking that when the hatch above opens, at least I can catch a momentary rush of fresh air. The minutes elapse, then the hours, and the sealed hull darkens along with the passage of time. I still anticipate that gust, but the hatch never moves. As the air grows thicker and more foul in the growing gloom, I brace myself. Night takes a firm hold, and the hull becomes almost pitch black. The prisoners are not allowed candles, of course, as fire might provide a means of escape, and thus the only illumination is the hint of moonlight that sneaks in through the gaps in the wooden slat walls. Exhaustion threatens to overwhelm me, although I know I cannot fall asleep, or I risk much greater vulnerability. Thoughts of Robert pervade my mind, and I weep silently in the blackness for the loss of the new life we were meant to embark upon this very night. A thud sounds in the hull. I see the outline of a man approaching slowly, and I ready myself to retaliate. When he comes close enough that I can discern bits of his face and dress, I see a hollow-faced older man, his dark hair shot through with light gray, wearing a tattered Continental Army uniform.
"Do not come any closer,"
I hiss, wanting to warn him, but not to awaken the sleeping prisoners.
I don't mean to scare you, Miss Morris. You are Elizabeth Morris, aren't you?
How does this man know my name? It is hardly as if Loring's assistant introduced me before he shoved me down the stairs. Panic surges through me.
Then don't approach me.
He takes a big step backward and whispers,
"Can you hear me from this distance?"
I nod.
"The last thing in the world that I want to do is frighten you. This place is terrifying enough on its own."
He coughs, an unnerving, rattling sound.
"You've done so much for our cause, and I simply want to offer my services to you, limited though they may be in this gruesome place."
"What do you think I've done for your cause? And how do you know who I am?"
He gestures to four men standing behind him, who've silently gathered.
"We have means of receiving information about the war, as well as letters and small parcels. And we have heard about what you did to stop Arnold and André. We are at your service."
In the days that follow, Lieutenant Bayard becomes my savior. From him, I learn that the only way to procure food and water on board, horrible though they may be, is to be part of a mess, a group of six individuals who gather outside the steward's room every morning and wait for the ringing of the steward's bell. Only then is each mess called by number, with one member lining up to receive the group's ration, served out of a small window in the steward's room. Without this designation, a prisoner is left to starve. Bayard reorganizes the groups to ensure that I count as part of his mess. Becoming part of it means that not only do I get my daily ration of rancid suet, biscuits filled with worms, and weevil-laden peas, but I get preferential treatment for water. If food is scarce on board the Jersey, water is even rarer. Brought aboard from a farm spring near Wallabout Bay, it is in such demand that extra soldiers are needed to guard the barrels containing it. A gallon a day for drinking, washing, and cooking is the maximum allotted, and even with Bayard's assistance, I can never get enough of the brackish liquid. Perhaps most important, Bayard and his men protect me from the prison guards who long to brutalize me. They nurse me back to health after the periodic beatings I received to elicit information about my fellow spies, and they buffer me from the most onerous of prisoner tasks, manning the pumps to ensure that the ship stays afloat despite the constant influx of water, and cleaning the latrines. Bayard and his men operate by their own code of honor, an allegiance that includes information. They share with me their biggest secret. By day, Elizabeth Bergen, a widow with three young children in occupied New York, gathers supplies from prisoners' families and attempts to bring them on board, delivering personal letters along with food and blankets. By night, she and a man named George Higday row a small boat alongside the Jersey, delivering updates about the war and, very occasionally, smuggling prisoners off it, a task made easier by the lack of records about the prisoners held here. This brave woman, a lifeline to those on board the prison ships, undertakes this dangerous work to strike out against the forces that killed her husband. Through Mrs. Bergen's brave efforts, I learn that Robert has been acquiring large sums of money, borrowing from everyone he knows, in an effort to ransom me off this ship. But I learn something else from Mrs. Bergen, a fact that perhaps Robert has not yet discovered. The British will never set me free, no matter the enormity of the sum he assembles. If Benedict Arnold's rage hasn't sealed my fate on the Jersey, then General Washington's decision to hang Major André for treason certainly does. No British authority will ever allow me to leave this ship alive. My poor Robert. It pains me to think of him tormenting himself for the circumstances that have befallen me. My capture wasn't his fault. I hadn't been as invisible as I'd believed myself to be at the many social occasions where I eavesdropped on the British soldiers and at home in the presence of Colonel Randolph. But it seems that Robert had been invisible. I pray that he soon realizes that my only hope of survival lies with the victory of the Continental Army, and that he directs his energy and fury toward that end. Only then might he free me and our baby. Chapter 13, September 14th, 1781, New York, New York. Only my pregnancy, apparent 5 months after I boarded the Jersey, merited me a private cell with a window. Even then, bribes to Loring and Bayard's threats to stage a riot were necessary to make the move happen before I actually gave birth. Since I moved into this closet-like chamber, I lament the company of my mess, those honorable men who kept me safe for those first long months. But the small circular porthole in my tiny room opens to allow me to feel the sun on my face and the wind in my hair. After days and weeks and months spent in rank captivity, largely below deck, I cannot imagine anything better. And neither can my baby. Once little Robert arrives one terrifying night. With his brown hair and matching eyes, so like his father's in coloring, he resembles Robert in his nature as well. Serious and curious, with deep, penetrating gazes. He is a lovely gift in this horrendous place, even with the challenges of feeding him and keeping him clean. We spend many happy days alone in that minuscule room, with only a hammock in one corner and a bucket in the other. But we have our window, and we have each other, as we enjoy the simple pleasures of the sun's warmth and the gentle spray of salt water from a rogue gust of wind, with the baby kicking gleefully. I only wish for my husband. He is in hiding, his invisibility finally giving way. I hear the news through the men in my mess, who whisper the information they glean from Mrs. Bergen in the morning distribution of rations. I knew the British would eventually identify him once they found me and undertook their investigation. Feeding the baby, who is healthy and robust despite our surroundings, drains the last vestiges of my energy each day. As he grows, I wane. Bayard and his men slip me extra food and water they can ill spare. The odd hard-boiled egg, an occasional half-rotten apple, even hard biscuits shaken free of the worms. And while the nourishment is welcome, I know I will only be able to sustain little Robert for so long. Pleas to Loring and his men to allow my baby to leave are met with derision and laughter. They'll grant his freedom only in exchange for the names of my fellow spies, I am told. And even then, I know they will never let me or my baby go. But I have a plan, one forged with Bayard's guidance in the long, dark winter nights of my pregnancy. I began my preparations before I even left the hull, and I continue them now. Bit by bit, I tear strips of fabric from the many-layered petticoat under my lilac gown, knotting them into a makeshift rope. When it reaches the length that Bayard told me was necessary, I begin weaving a tiny hammock to attach to one end, all of which I keep hidden under my filthy skirt. And then I wait for the full moon and the signal. One September morning, Bayard whispers to me, "It is time," with a squeeze of my hand. He alone knows how terrible and wonderful tonight will be. As the sun recedes on the horizon and my tiny cell darkens, I sing lullabies to my baby, asleep on my breast. I listen to his soft breathing and feel the lift of his chest. I want to savor every last sensation while I can. Then I hear it, the sound of the oar in the water. Keeping little Robert close, I rise and peer out the window, down into the vast, dark ocean. In the light emitted from the moon, I see the outline of the rowboat and the silhouettes of two figures waiting directly below my cell. I hesitate,
tears streaming down my face. How can I part from my baby? Will he be safe as I lower him into the waiting boat of Mrs. Bergen? But then I think, how can I not give him an opportunity at life? At a life with his father, no less, knowing his slim chances of survival on board the Jersey. Sobbing silently, I wrap my sleeping baby in the hammock I fashioned especially for him. I check the safety of its harness and the strength of the rope. Time is ticking away too fast, I know, and I must act with haste. But how can I say goodbye? Quickly, I think, or not at all. I kiss him one last time on his soft cheek, slide him through the porthole, and lower him down the side of the Jersey. Praying that he will not cry and alert the guards, I watch as a figure stands up on the rowboat and reaches for him. He is safe, I think, as I watch the rowboat fade into the distance. And I am left with a crippling mix of relief and despair. I slide down the wall and sit in a heap on the rough wooden floor. How will I survive the Jersey without him? His sweet smile, his solemn stare, his gentle breath. It is then that I realize, fully and completely for the first time, that I will not. Reaching deep into my dress pocket, I slide out my wedding ring and think about the future reunion of both my darling Roberts. And this alone gives me peace. The image of my husband flashes through my mind and I smile, thinking on our stolen moments together, spent plotting the downfall of the British. One particular conversation surfaces with special vividness, in which I lamented the invisibility of women, even when it assisted me in my work for the Culper Ring. How I long for true invisibility now, I think. With it, I would not need to rely on my work for the revolution and on my child to liberate me from this hell by establishing a legacy for me after I am gone. Instead, I could pass specter-like through the walls of the Jersey directly into freedom, and only then into history. Author's note. This story about Agent 355 grew out of my mission. What exactly is that mission? Well, through my novels, I am determined to excavate from the past the most important, complex, and fascinating women of history and bring their stories into the light of the present day, where we can finally perceive their contributions as well as the insights they bring to modern-day issues. While I was knee-deep in research about the Revolutionary War, considering some of the founding mothers as possible book subjects, I came across the dangerous espionage work undertaken by the mysterious female agent 355. Once I understood the importance of her extraordinary efforts to the outcome of the Revolutionary War, I knew I had to turn my attention to her story. Agent 355 first became known when letters surfaced from members of George Washington's famous New York-based Culper spy ring, in which Robert Townsend mentioned a lady of his acquaintance who was well-positioned to assist them in their efforts to gather information about the British. Using the Culper ring's code, he referred to this woman as Agent 355. Given Townsend's residence in New York City, and given that the intelligence he gathered in the months that followed came from someone with close access to British spymaster Major Andre and his men, historians have assumed that Agent 355 was a New York-based lady, someone with social connections that would give her access to overheard conversations between Andre and his fellow officers. These were conversations that, of course, the British would not expect a woman to understand, including discussions about Major Andre's secret agreement with General Benedict Arnold to betray the Continental Army and deliver West Point to the British. Since the discovery of those letters, several historical women have been floated as possible candidates for the role of Agent 355, from various family members and friends of Townsend, to Benedict Arnold's own wife, Peggy, to a young woman referred to as Betty Floyd, assumed to be related to William Floyd, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, and a delegate in the Continental Congress. Upon close assessment, however, none of these contenders seemed to fit.
While many were brave patriots who undertook heroic work on behalf of the Revolutionary War, those women could not have been Agent 355 because they either weren't in New York City at the time in question or did not have the necessary contact with Major Andre and his officers. But when I took one of the names that kept cropping up as a possibility, Betty Floyd, and examined her and the surname Floyd through a slightly different lens, I thought I might have a prospect for the Agent 355 of my story. Many of the members of the Culper spy ring, in fact, were in some way connected with William Floyd and his kin, either as neighbors or family members, as is the case with Townsend, his fellow agent Abraham Woodhull, and the creator of the Culper ring itself, Benjamin Talmadge, who later became Floyd's son-in-law. What if Betty Floyd wasn't the specific relative of William Floyd that historians had presumed and ruled out, but a distant relation of the Floyd family with a different surname? Someone who'd become known as Floyd over time, due to her connection to the patriotic family. Only then did I realize that I had my Agent 355, a brave young woman with rebellious ideals, living in New York City with her affluent, British-supporting parents amidst the social whirl focused on officers quartering with the city's wealthy inhabitants. This Betty Floyd would have had ready access to Major Andre and his men, as well as Robert Townsend through his work as a merchant shop owner or as a writer for the Royal Gazette, which gave him entree to social occasions. And this Betty Floyd could have been ultimately caught and imprisoned on the horrific HMS Jersey, an incarceration that would explain Robert Townsend's reportedly panicked flight from New York, his desperate scrounging for ransom money, and his raising a child named Robert Townsend Jr., who, incidentally, was instrumental in constructing the Prison Ship Martyrs Monument, a memorial to the many American prisoners who died in the British prison ships during the course of the Revolutionary War, when he reached adulthood. We will probably never know the identity of the real Agent 355, and it is likely that my fictional version is just that, fictional. But she existed, and whoever she truly was, we owe her a debt of gratitude as a nation. Her heroism and contributions deserve to be widely known. Without the skillful espionage we attribute to her, the duplicity of Benedict Arnold might not have been discovered in time, and the British might have taken hold of the strategic West Point. Who knows what impact that might have had in the outcome of the Revolutionary War? How much of our freedom is due to Agent 355's courage and sacrifice? Clearly, Agent 355, whoever she might have been, should join the pantheon of historical figures we admire. But until we change the chronicle of the past to include women and their legacies, we will continue to view the past more restrictively than it was. And we risk carrying those perspectives over into the present, perpetuating the pervasive marginalization of women's contributions. Rewriting the historical narrative to include women from all eras, where they've been all along. Working, but hiding in plain sight, is my mission.
This has been an Audible original, produced by Audible Originals. Written by Marie Benedict. Performed by Emily Rankin. Executive producers, Laura Blackman and Chelsea Pita. Acquisition and development, Joanne Peretz. Vice President of Audible Studios, Mike Charzik. Editor-in-Chief, Audible Original Publishing, David Blum. Copyright 2020 by Audible Originals, LLC. Sound recording copyright 2020 by Audible Originals, LLC.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.